Welcome to the Data Points podcast, created by the Bloomberg Center for Government Excellence at Johns Hopkins University. We explore the ways the public sector is using data to understand complex issues, engage residents, and ultimately improve quality of life, particularly for underserved communities. My name is Evan Serpik, and I'm the Director of Communications at GovX. Today, we're discussing the 2014 Digital Accountability and Transparency Act, or DATA Act, the nation's first open data law. The DATA Act standardized data for more than $6 trillion in annual spending and made it possible for taxpayers to monitor how federal funds are allocated and trace those funds to direct investments in their communities. It became a model for open data laws around the country and around the world. Last week, GovX hosted an event at the new Hopkins Bloomberg Center in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the DATA Act's 10th anniversary, featuring a wide range of speakers, including Senator Mark Warner, who sponsored the DATA Act, Mayor Tim Kelly of Chattanooga, and a wide range of federal officials, including several who played key roles in passing and implementing the DATA Act. We are joined today by Amy Holmes, Executive Director of the Bloomberg Center for Government Excellence. Before she came to GovX, Amy was Director of the Task Force on Government Performance on the Senate Budget Committee, where she played a key role in drafting the DATA Act and getting it passed. And then, as a Deputy Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of the Treasury, she played a key role in implementing it. As Senator Warner said at our anniversary event, no one has had more fingers on everything involved in the DATA Act than Amy. So we're going to, after I talk to Amy for a few minutes, we're going to be able to listen to some highlights from the 10th anniversary event. But Amy, first of all, thank you so much for being here. I wanted to see if I could just ask you a couple quick questions.
Sounds good. Happy to continue to chat about the progress that we made with the DATA Act and the results achieved.
Great. So if you can think back to 2011, when you began working on what would become the DATA Act, what was the vision? What were you trying to achieve?
Yeah, so back in 2011, there were kind of two things happening. The first was we had just gone through the implementation of another big piece of legislation, the Recovery, Accountability, and Transparency Act. So this was the response to the economic crisis we had back in 2008, 2009. And in that law, it created a special focus on transparency and a very big focus on how to ensure that the funds were going to be used for their intended purpose. And they had a very big focus on prevention of fraud or improper payments as, you know, associated with that implementation. And so there was an approach taken that we thought was really promising around how to provide greater transparency and accountability over the funds. So we were watching that progress and watching that work at the same time that we had stood up in 2009, this task force on government performance on the Senate Budget Committee. And our work was really focused on how do you get Congress access to better data so that they can use it to inform all of their oversight and spending decisions that they make and ensuring that programs were achieving the results that they wanted them to achieve. And so I think those two things were happening in the backdrop, and there was a broadening awareness that the transparency and the structure for how we were organizing all this financial data across the government just wasn't in a format that was really helpful to the members of Congress in the Senate and the House. And so both sides were looking at ways to improve. And so that's what really started the work on the DATA Act, was a focus on how can we get more granular, more real-time financial data across the whole government so that you can hone in and see, answer any questions that the members have about, you know, where the money is at any given time. And so that was the vision of like having a one-stop website where you could go in and actually see real-time how much money's been spent, how much is left, and who got the funds and how they were used. So that was the goal of the law initially.
Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, this was really brand new. I mean, I know that you all didn't really have a template to base this on. Were there things that you were looking at or thinking about as you went about drafting the law?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when we started in 2011, the first bill that was introduced actually created a whole separate agency that would set new financial standards and do all of the reporting independently of the current structure of government. And as we began discussing that and having discussions, especially with the executive branch agencies at the White House and at the Treasury, it became clear that there might be a more efficient way to do this work. And we found the officials within the Treasury who were already responsible for doing a lot of the reporting and data collection. And it seemed like a better solution to actually embed these new reporting requirements at the Treasury, where they already had some existing expertise and infrastructure to leverage. And so we pivoted the legislation for the second version that was introduced, the final version that eventually became law, was a different approach where we didn't have a standalone agency. It was actually embedded at the Treasury Department. And one reason why I think that was really important is because Treasury issues majority of the payments and financial transactions for the whole of government. So if you get a Social Security check, that came from Treasury. If you get, you know, you're paying a fee to go into a U.S. Park Service, it goes into the Treasury. So they're kind of they're closest to the money. And I think that if you're going to have better accountability and transparency, that having it not another layer on top of Treasury, but embedded in the way closest to where those transactions are occurring, is the best quality data that you can rely on, because they made the transaction. Therefore, they can be responsible for the accurate accounting and transparency of it. So to me, embedding it at Treasury was important for many reasons, as I learned more and as we thought through the most efficient way of executing and implementing the law. So that was a journey, you know, and I think we did that exploration in a real bipartisan way that was, you know, we did that work together, which was great.
Yeah, I mean, I know that identifying the Treasury as the key location for this work was essential. And then I know you really did a lot more work beyond that to build a coalition. What were the sort of the key elements as you built that coalition to getting people to buy into this?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, one of the most important aspects of this work is having strong leaders who have the authority and a shared vision. So, you know, I think we were really lucky that Senator Mark Warner, who is the member that I worked for, and Congressman Daryl Issa, who at the time was the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, both of them were just really committed and had a shared vision for what needed to be done. And they were really committed to making progress. And because of that, they were successful and they built support on both sides of the aisle of Capitol Hill, bringing in other Republican and Democratic leaderships to give more momentum to the passage of the bill. And I think that's critical for any policy strategy, is that you need to have the right leaders in place who have a same vision and they, you know, agree on the problem and are committed to solving it. So, I mean, I think their leadership, without it, we wouldn't have been able, you know, we were going to find the best solution to support what they wanted to do. And then we built a team of staff from Republican, Democrat, multiple committees working together to build common facts. And we held dozens of bipartisan briefings and we modified this approach together when we learned more and figured out ways to make it the most effective approach to accomplishing what the members were really looking to do. And in fact, we built such a strong partnership across the staff that were working together for the House and Senate leadership that we pre-conferenced the legislation so that the House and the Senate passed identical versions of the bill so that we could get it to the president's desk sooner. And we didn't have to post passage conference the two bills. We actually did it in advance. And that would have never worked without a strong trust from and coalition built by the members and supported by their staff. And so I think those were really, really important. We also built internal and external allies. So, you know, we brought civil society with us, data coalition, financial management and audit groups, local government. You know, it was a whole coalition of people who thought this could be helpful. This is the right thing to do. And so I think that was also a really important part of the process.
Yeah, you mentioned a statistic to me that was really staggering, that in 2014, the year the Data Act was passed, more than 7,000 bills were introduced in Congress, but only about 100 became law, which is just incredibly long odds. I wondered if you had, I mean, you really explained some of the key factors to getting it passed. Were there moments when you just didn't think it was going to make it to the finish line?
Yes, there were many, many moments when you weren't really sure it was going to get there. But I think, again, the leadership that the members brought to it and their focus and determination to get it done and to work within, you know, the confines of a very tight legislative calendar. And I think It was that commitment to this is a problem that we should be able to solve. And that focus, I think, really pushed it across the finish line.
Yeah, and I know that even once the bill was passed, of course, you continued at the Treasury and worked on implementation, which sounds like was maybe an even bigger challenge. What were the biggest challenges in getting the law implemented?
Yeah, well, it took 3 years to pass the law, and then it took the law gave the government 3 years to implement it. You know, I will say working on both sides from start to the full implementation at the Treasury, that I think that the implementation is harder than the passage. And you just cited the statistics around how many bills actually became law that year. So it was not it was a big challenge just to get passed and to become law. But, you know, so it's saying a lot to say that the implementation was harder, but that's because we had to implement this new law across hundreds of federal agencies, across the entire federal government, one of the most complex and difficult organizations to make change in the world. It is one of the most complex, biggest organizations. You know, we're talking trillions of dollars that we're accounting for and collecting data for at a granular level. And so I think that, you know, was a huge challenge in and of itself. But the approach taken, which you heard a lot about at the event last week, was really critical in that we built We employed modern, agile development processes for how we built the standards, how we built the internal data broker and the external transparency site in a way that was really focused on the end users of those tools. Because of that agile, incremental approach, we could experiment on the best ways to do this work, and then you could pivot quickly, figure out what works, what didn't, instead of this long multi-year requirements gathering and all of this type of traditional approach to building technology and government. We took a different one, one that was novel and new at the time for government. We weren't doing many agile efforts, even though that had become commonplace in the private sector. So this was a great opportunity to really teach and demonstrate the power of the new approaches to a very broad audience across the government, because so many people were involved in the implementation. So I think that approach was essential. We would not have been able to be successful without it. I also think it's important that in the standards that we built for the Data Act implementation, they were extensible. And we started with the minimally required data, what was required by the law. We got that right. And then over time, what we've seen is that we were able to add more data elements, data requirements. In other emergencies, you know, they built a framework that could be extended. For example, like during the pandemic, Treasury was able to add new identifiers quickly because we had a framework to track that economic response, ensuring that the right communities were getting the resources from the government to support the pandemic response. And also, you know, they were able to do that around the historic infrastructure investments of the last couple of years. We're able to be able to track those funds and do the oversight and the management of those funds because of what we built with the Data Act. So the extensible standard has been able to be leveraged to support more and more. And I think that was, you know, what we always envisioned. And I'm really glad it did work out that way. So that data-centric model was really key in the success that we found. And so I think you heard a lot about that last week at the event.
Yeah, for sure. You really heard a lot of the leaders, including the local leaders, really talking about how it has the Data Act really laid the foundation for so much additional work. I wonder if, and we also talked last week at the event about the future and potential additional needs. And I wondered if you left that event thinking that there is a need for additional open data legislation on the federal level. And if so, if you have an idea of what it might address.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always still work to be done. The Data Act put in place an incremental step, you know, of trying to improve the transparency. I think we were successful in that, but I think there are some more things that need to be done. Some of the data around the individual contracts and grants and the subawards. So if you give a grant to a state and they issue a subgrant to a local government or to another community organization who's delivering services for the government, like we don't have enough traceability all through all of those levels. And so there needs to be more standards and more focus on improving the quality of the contracting and grant data and getting down to the subaward level that is still needs focus. I think there's been a lot of the Government Accountability Office, the auditors who've looked at this data, they have spoken a lot about improvements in those areas. And I think that needs attention. I also think a goal that we always had back to my days in the Senate was to, not only do we want to know where the money goes, we want to be able to know what we got in return and what were the results. So finding ways to link not only this is where money was spent and where what program it supported, but what were the results? What was the performance related to that? So like, how do we think always the goal is to always have financial and performance data more integrated so we can answer questions like that. So I think that is also an opportunity where this work could evolve over time and how we bring that together in ways that demonstrate that to the public. It goes a long way also to, you know, having more trust in the way that the government works, the way that the people see the work of the government so that they know what was spent and how it is helping them in their local communities. So that's important.
Yeah, that really reminds me of something Senator Warner said at the event, which was the whole idea of the Data Act was not just transparency for its own sake, but transparency so that the data can actually be used, mm-hmm. you know, on the local level and throughout government. So we are going to be able to listen to some of the highlights from the event last week. I just wondered if there were any moments for you that really stood out from the event.
Yeah, I hope, you know, I think obviously hearing from our elected leaders, Senator Warner and others, I mean, really great to hear their continued focus on this. Like Senator Warner is not the kind of leader who passes something and walks away. He was very much involved with the implementation and oversight and making sure that we were accomplishing the results. I think that is really important with things like this. I think also, you know, really, I think highlighting some of the change management success that we found in the Data Act. I think that's every data leader knows that it's not the technical standards or the technical infrastructure that really holds up progress sometimes. It's really how do you lead change? How do you bring people to the table to have them understand the value and the need for this new data and how it can better support the work? And so it's that change management story that I think comes through from the event and hearing from the leaders who are leading that change and sustaining that change over time. I think that's the hard part in all of this work where you're trying to have a transformation to be a more data-driven organization. You have to have that sustained leadership. And that's what we really, I think, comes through in the event, whether it's from Senator Warner, whether it's from Mayor Kelly, who's leading, I think, a substantial change in the city of Chattanooga, and you're hearing it from those leaders who are actually leading the implementation directly. It's how you do that. And you have to have leaders at all levels to be able to push forward this change. It's at the top, it's at the middle, and it's on the ground level doing the work in the communities and in the agencies, which is so important. So that's what comes through the event for me, is that this sustained change can happen. It is possible, and it produces really incredible results that we need in the public sector in order to be successful and to deliver the quality of service that the public deserves.
Agreed. No, it was really wonderful to be in the room. So thank you so much for taking the time to go through all that with us. We're going to switch now to listening to some of those highlights, but I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
GovX's event, Reflections on the 10th Anniversary of the Data Act, Examining the Impact and the Future of Open Data, took place at the Hopkins Bloomberg Center in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, May 8th, 2024. To see the full recording of the event, go to govx.jhu.edu. The event opened at 9 a.m. with introductions from Beth Blauer, Associate Vice Provost for Public Sector Innovation at Johns Hopkins University, Luke McGowan, Head of Federal Initiatives, Government Innovation at Bloomberg Philanthropies, and Amy Holmes, Executive Director of the Bloomberg Center for Government Excellence, or GovX, at Johns Hopkins University. Here are some highlights from their introductions.
Good morning and welcome to Johns Hopkins University's flagship Washington, D.C. campus here at the Hopkins Bloomberg Center. There really is no better place to celebrate this important anniversary than right here in the heart of American democracy. Our collective work is the heartbeat of this institution, and this conversation and celebration is just the beginning.
You know, this event really represents just the latest evolution in the work that Bloomberg Philanthropies and Johns Hopkins University have been doing together for years to really support and make sure that we are at the leading edge of these issues on open data and how government innovation can work on the ground.
Since 2011, that's a long time ago, I have watched this data act grow from an idea to a robust movement across the globe, inspiring a new approach for linking financial data and unlocking the power of connected data for public benefit.
Next on the agenda was a panel discussion on developing the data strategy for the first open data law, moderated by Robert Shea, president of GovNavigators and a former official at the Office of Management and Budget under President George H.W. Bush. The panelists included Ed Dasev, former special advisor to President Barack Obama charged with implementing the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, Caitlin Devine, chief data officer of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General, and Christina Ho, board member for Public Company Accounting Oversight Board by the Securities and Exchange Commission. We'll hear highlights from Robert Shea, Ed Dasev, and Christina Ho.
What we're going to talk about today is not arguably, I don't think it's arguable, the most significant advancement in government transparency ever in the world before or after.
So for Data Act, we were very focused on users and also stakeholders, and we had a very robust outreach strategy, really all the credit goes to Amy, and we had monthly meetings with the stakeholders. We built this product, you know, in the open, which means the code were on GitHub, people can look at it. We also had the beta website 2 years prior to the statutory deadline, soliciting feedback from the public so that we could continue to improve. And I think the whole process really just, you know, that this openness to allow, and you know, not just that we're implementing a transparency law and putting out all the data, but the process of implementing it, it was transparent.
What we're trying to say at the Agile Government Center is that the principles...
It's agile.
The principles of Agile can be applied at the project level, the program level, and the entire whole of an organization level. I wrote some words down before we started, and I'm going to start with the first one. There are only six words. Motivation. You talked about the need for motivation. You got to want to really do this. You got to put your heart and soul into it. So Agile has to start with the idea that you are motivated to do things. You're motivated to change your mindset. Carol Dweck, a professor at Stanford, talks about going from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. In Agile, you have to have a growth mindset. But you have to be guided by a set of principles. And there has to be a framework for those principles to actually do things, to implement things, to have leadership exercise mission and vision using evidence and metrics to guide what's going on, to collaborate with the public and to have customers as part of the conversation. I'm reading my Agile Government Framework, by the way, which you're all going to get. I couldn't use slides today, so you're going to get my propaganda as it comes in. You collaborate in networks and using small integrated teams in order to do the work in a rapid way. Speed is important, but there has to be persistent iteration. It says so right here, persistent iteration. So there has to be principles and a framework to implement those principles because you're trying to demonstrate increased competence. Why increased competence? Because you want to try to improve trust in government. The purpose of Agile, especially Agile organizations, is to increase competence while respecting and promoting values such as integrity, transparency, inclusion, along the way. That's what Agile government is all about. And I'm going to try to enlist all of you in being part of a movement toward Agile government. And you don't have to do anything other than read there'll only be 3 or 4 pages. There'll be slides that look like this. They'll be in PowerPoint. And we're ready, we stand ready at the National Academy of Public Administration to work with anybody who wants to begin promoting Agile ways of doing things. We think that if you have the motivation, change your mindset, look at the Agile government principles, apply the integrated framework in order to produce a more competent organization, the trust will improve. I just read a report yesterday For those of you who don't do it, it's worth subscribing to The Mandarin. The Mandarin is an Australian publication that comes out every day. It's kind of like GovExec for Australia. And you get to kind of look at what they're doing and what we're doing. BCG just finished a study. I'm not trying to promote BCG. They just finished a study for the government of Australia, which increased its overall trust in its citizens in a relatively brief period of time from roughly 60% to over 70% by demonstrating continued competence, according to BCG. We think that's possible in the federal government here, and it's also possible within your own local governments. Local governments are now more trusted than the federal government. Part of the problem of trust, we just had Gallup come in and do a dog and pony show for us. Part of the problem in the federal government is the political nature of the antics that you see every day in the federal government. But part of it is that customers don't have a good experience with service delivery. And as a result, they're not willing to trust the agency that provided that.
Next, we'll hear remarks from Senator Mark Warner, who sponsored the 2014 Data Act.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
You know, it is great to be with a group of data nerds at 10 o'clock in the morning. It is kind of cool. And it is a great pleasure for me to be here celebrating the 10th year anniversary of the Data Act. You know, as we think about the progress that has been made in this field, we've got to remember, and there's, I saw Robert Shea and I saw Ed on the last panel. I think about those early days when Amy and I first started working together at the Budget Committee, and then saw as we got the bill passed and signed into law, Amy then went on to Treasury and helped on the implementation. And I don't think as we look back over this past decade, in terms of bringing greater transparency, there's no one that has gotten, had more fingers on everything involved than Amy. So Amy, thank you as well for your great, great work. And I ask Amy, like, how many other electeds, I know we've got the mayor of Chattanooga here, or how many other has-been electeds, because some of the has-beens were the people who were involved in all this stuff. But if we go back those 10 years, and I think about it was Rob Portman and I, my good friend, and Daryl Issa, and who still, and he and I are still talking about what may be the next iteration, and Elijah Cummings. And as Amy mentioned, here I was relatively, you know, brand new member of the Senate, new member of the Budget Committee, had just come away from being governor of Virginia, where we had put some points on the board in transparency and better delivery, was very proud of that best managed state recognition. But it was baffling to me, even though I'd been a governor and worked on Capitol Hill as a kid, how little understanding policymakers had about the federal budget. How we had all these stovepiped accounts, how in some categories things were recognized as a cost, they were otherwise recognized as the grant, and they may be the same program. It made no sense, and there was absolutely very, very little transparency. Now, everybody in this room, as the kind of data folks as we all are, we were seeing about $900 billion in direct assistance data misreported on the USA spending. Obviously, lack of transparency and an incomplete and thoroughly confusing process of financial reporting. And the taxpayers had no reliable or consistent way to track how their money was being spent. Passage of the Data Act pushed us in a real way towards a more open and data-driven government. Now, I know in this room I'm preaching to the choir, and I think it is important that we realize passing any single bill isn't the end of this process. It is an ongoing process. So in addition to bringing a new level of transparency to our federal spending, the law's reforms also make government more accessible to grant applicants and recipients, as well as federal contractors, by streamlining and improving reporting interfaces. And I know we've got a lot of folks here from cities and counties around the country. That's terribly important in this process as well. Now, how do we go forward? Finding ways to continue to build on the progress under the Data Act is critical. Passing the law was that, again, just a huge initial step. And I remember all of the implementation battles. I will have to acknowledge, even though I'm a minor data nerd compared to some of you guys, I never had actually fully under the number of times I mispronounced schema and sometimes with very inappropriate other comments. A few times, I won't go back on that. But those battles were, you know, I think were important. And I think the foundational work is absolutely vital in moving us to a state where proactive, evidence-based decision-making is the norm and not the exception. Finding ways to further this effort has been something I have been involved in over the last number of years. In 2018, and by that point I was already on the Intel Committee and was starting to get a better understanding of geospatial activities, I worked with then-Senator Hatch to pass into law the Geospatial Data Act into law, which endeavored to streamline and standardize the way the federal government manages vast quantities of geospatial data. And it developed additional performance reporting for agencies so that Congress could, again, better manage agencies' effectiveness. Latest efforts, at least out of my shop, came in 2022 when I led the Senate work on the Financial Data Transparency Act. As you know, the FDTA is designed to modernize how data is collected by our financial regulators, making it digitally accessible, consistent, and therefore more useful to the public and the agencies involved. The FDTA was the only financial services-related bill to pass the NDAA that year, and I continue to work to make sure it gets implemented correctly. But just like the Data Act, and this is one of the areas in a town where a lot of things are pretty partisan at this point, this topic is still broadly bipartisan. On the FDTA, I worked with Chairman McHenry from the House and my good friend Mike Crapo to get it done. Now, I hope we can keep that spirit going and as we work again towards the common goals that all of us have in this room. The promise of the Data Act and these other efforts, however, has never been increased transparency just for the sake of transparency. The promise has always been in the utility of the data. What can policymakers do by making better informed, more robust, and having a more accurate assessment of our data? What can citizens and transparency advocates do, armed with better insight into how their dollars are being spent? A big piece, I believe, of that puzzle is in advancing usability in terms of how we invest in our workforce. You need people who understand the data and know how to work with it in order to execute creative and innovative uses. The executive branch has a lot to say on this front with the development of federal data strategies. Congress, I think, certainly has a role in implementing policies that support those efforts and fund workforce development. The efforts by all of you here in this room are vital too, in leading the way within your agencies, your organizations, and for those of you who are partners at the local and county level, in building out that workforce pipeline. I look forward to getting a report back from Amy and some of my staff who will be here in hearing more about today's conversations and some of the thinking that will come out of this event, because there are so many more questions we have to address. For example, I think I may have the distinction of being, at least in the Senate, the person who spent more time sitting with AI experts than anyone else. And let me quickly add, as somebody who had a tech background, even though I've spent more time on AI, at least for me, there is no linear relationship between more time spent and me actually understanding fully all the implications of AI. I think back a year ago when I thought who had the most data, who had the most compute, who had the most engineers would win, and all those models are fundamentally changing. But boy, oh boy, if we can bring the power of AI to data governance, and how AI can, frankly, make this data more usable, more understandable, and particularly as we think about the volumes, it could be extraordinarily transformative. And this will be the case, in most aspects of AI, but I can't think of a space where it will have more than how we use and manipulate our data. I'm not very good at formal remarks. Let me just go ahead and say, how we have transparency in a way that citizens can understand where their dollars are headed. I mean, many of you are state and local officials. I remember when I was a governor, we were so much further along, even 12 or 14 years ago, about transparency, better than the federal government. But trying to earn that citizen respect is extraordinarily critical. Uh, and, and, in this day and time. What you do to make sure that we're better informed, whether you're the policymaker, whether it's your city council, your board of supervisors, your members of the House or the Senate, is absolutely essential. In a time, as chairman of the Intelligence Committee right now, and spending a lot of time on how we maintain election security this year, I'm terrified because of AI. I'm terrified because of the number of nation states that may try to interfere in our elections. But I'm terrified as well because there's just a whole lot more Americans now that believe really wacky stuff in terms of conspiracy theories. And part of that plays itself out in terms of how people present and oftentimes misrepresent what government is actually doing. And having folks who understand data use, make it transparent, make sure that, again, a citizen, a grant maker, knows what is a grant versus what is an expense and how they sometimes the two should not be miscategorized in different categories is extraordinarily important. This wouldn't, we've still got work to do, but I don't think we would be as far along if we hadn't passed the Data Act 10 years ago. I hope you will, while I still don't have the expertise of Amy on my staff, I still can rely on her here at Bloomberg. I hope you'll continue to look to me and others. This is still a broadly bipartisan subject because I think the more we can move this along, the more we can have a better informed citizenry, a more efficient use of our taxpayer dollars. And at the end of the day, that means a better community, a better state government, and better federal government. So thank you all for having me today. Congratulations on 10 years. Here's to the next 10 years of greater data transparency. Thank you all very much.
Mayor Tim Kelly was not a planned speaker for the event, but he came as a guest and he agreed to give some remarks. Here they are.
Thank you so much and good morning, everybody. I will keep it brief because this is all ad-libbed, frankly. I don't have the curse of prepared remarks, but I am very passionate about this, and I'm happy to be here to celebrate the 10th anniversary of that act with you because, again, I never ran for student council before becoming mayor. I was a business guy who was raised at the knee of an engineer with OCD, so I never had a chance as regarding the importance of data. He would always say to me, son, the key to happiness in life is to see the world as it is rather than as you wish it were. And that never left me. And, coming into office with the advent and being a tech guy from my business background, I was never confused and was lucky. Tim Moreland is here with the head of our innovation delivery performance is here with us this morning. So we had a really good head start, thanks to Mayor Burke, my predecessor in this regard. And I'll sound a bit like a broken record here, but for me, it's about two things. Bloomberg, we couldn't do any of this without Bloomberg. I'll probably close with that again. But one of the many, many things that Bloomberg does to make city government, local government stronger is the city leadership initiative that they put on with Harvard. And what we sort of governed by in Chattanooga is the strategic triangle, gaining public trust, executing, convening, and then doing it all over again. And internally, using data to execute better is a critically important project. We are hard at work on that every day. And I'm glad this act was passed 10 years ago because, ladies and gentlemen, as you all know, it is a journey. It is a cultural revolution to try to get people out of their ruts, very frankly, in local government, working from instinct and not from the data. I am preaching to the choir. And when you're talking about your local fire department or police department or homeless services department, it is tough. And in Chattanooga, with Tim's help, every cabinet meeting, every Monday morning, every single cabinet member reports out on their data. And it is going to be a journey over time. And ultimately, not only is it about internal performance and execution, it's also about transparency and trust. I mean, we're at a period of time when democracy is, under open threat. As a form of government, and as the senator said, it's incumbent upon us to make things as transparent as possible. Well, I'm proud of the work we've done in Chattanooga. We've just published our initial budget. The website went up with all the data there. Even my own internal folks said, you know, they expected to have to go in there and parse the data. It's parsed, right? It's transparent. And that level of engagement, I mean, if we can't do it right at the local government level, then, you know, God help the state and federal government. I mean, it really has to start there. So it's a hugely important project. And I will sort of pivot to the AI thing. I mean, I'm in town actually for a AI for National Competitiveness Conference because it is a very big deal. And I spoke yesterday to a group about what we're up to in Chattanooga along these same lines. But we are hard at work there to get out in front of what this bus coming at us is looking like and how we can, you know, ride it rather than be run over by it. And so we've got a team working with Tim's team and our technology services team to make our data available. Because again, it was actually on this very stage at Bloomberg City Lab. Mitch Weiss was here doing demos for us a little less than a year ago with a room full of mayors, showing us all the things that GPT-4 can do with data sets. And if we don't get as good at that internally as our residents do, then we're in trouble. So we've got to incorporate that into the work that we do. And again, it's not only a threat, it's a huge opportunity because, I'm looking very forward to uploading our entire city code and being able to, you know, have somebody just sort of type in a bot and ask, you know, how do I get a permit? Or, you know, can I put my garbage can out on a, you know, what day do I put my garbage can out? It gets a lot more complicated than that, which is why we haven't done it yet. But we will do it. And again, I think it's a huge, huge opportunity for us. So thank you all for being here. Again, this is critically, critically important work to our cities, our counties, the state, the federal level. And I appreciate everything you're doing. And again, first and last, I will say thank you to Bloomberg and all they do to convene around this topic because it is hugely, hugely important. Thank you.
Next, GovX Director Amy Holmes returned to the stage to talk about Data Act leadership lessons with David Labrick, Fiscal Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of the Treasury.
So looking back, what do you think are like the most significant accomplishments of the Data Act over the last 10 years?
Yeah, I think, you know, any time that you're doing a government-wide initiative, it's going to be bound to be enormously complex. It's hard to move the largest enterprise in the world to do anything. And so, you know, you have just, you know, you have so many different systems, you have so many different sort of organizational cultures and the like. And so it's hard. And so you have to be very thoughtful and you have to have a number of conditions in place in order to be successful. One of those things helps, and I'm glad to see we had Senator Warner here and sort of telling you it's nice to have authority, right? So, you know, it was despite the fact that the Data Act didn't come with much of any funding, certainly not for the agencies, we were going to ask the agencies to do some very different, difficult things in terms of compiling data. And so having that authority, and it was given to the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with OMB in many of these cases, was critical to that because it's hard to go out to the agencies and sort of tell them, hey, we want you to do something differently. We haven't given you funding, and would you please do it? And quite frankly, many of them did do that, by the way, but it was always quite nice to have the authority there. I think also I would say is, you know, I really give credit to sort of the architects, both on the congressional side, Amy and the team and others who sort of put the legislation together and were very thoughtful about what should be done. But also once that was done, I should mention that there were not a lot of people very enthusiastic about this legislation. Amy can probably speak to mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Even Treasury was not initially very enthusiastic about the legislation. I think once, though, that we got into it and we understood the position that we played, I think we got very enthusiastic and said, hey, we really need to take a leadership role here. And quite frankly, I think when Treasury decides it wants to do something, we tend to do things fairly well. And we really decided this was going to be an important commitment and something that, you know, I certainly devoted a good deal of my time when I came to the main Treasury from the Bureau. But I also would want to give a lot of credit to the folks who sat down and really thought strategically about what we were trying to do to create the vision. So there was a white paper that was written very early on, and Christina Ho, who's here, I think spoke earlier, was really critical to that. And putting together a kind of really thinking through, and I mentioned is that if you go back and look at the early papers, the early iterations, it wasn't exactly perfect. In fact, you kind of, some of our thinking evolved significantly, but that also comes to another key factor, the agile methodology, about being sort of thinking to yourself, a small group of people getting together and think, how do you make big change in government? It doesn't take lots of people, it is a small group of people. And that was a really dedicated, committed team of people who sat down and said, this is important, we really want to do it well. And putting that vision together, at any time when we wavered, we'd always go back to the vision and we'd say, hey, what were we trying to accomplish here? From that vision, we had very good project management in terms of looking at the work streams, the critically important work streams. And I think there were four or five of them at the time that we worked very in a very disciplined way. I know Christina and Amy even would sort of laugh at me and say, I'd pull the chart out and say, well, you know, how are we doing in this work stream? You know, like, you know, what more do we need to do? How do we be more disciplined in this work stream? And one of those work streams, which I think would be another thing which is very critical to success of a project like this, is outside stakeholders. We got a lot of criticism early on for sort of like, you know, were you moving fast enough? Could you do it? That was good. I mean, quite frankly, it was actually quite good that we had a lot of the outside entities and interest groups were saying, you need to do this. Entities like GAO saying, this is important. You know, transparency groups saying, this is important. And so that was one of our work streams. How do you manage, you know, sort of the outside stakeholders, and how do you make sure that you use that feedback and that, in some cases, criticism to actually drive government forward? You know, for us, it was, you know, very easy to kind of, you know, go back to OMB and go back to the agencies and say, hey, we're getting criticized here. You don't want that. And, you know, in a spirit of sort of public service appreciation month of, you know, trust in government. You know, in terms of like, none of us want to be in a situation where people don't trust what we're doing and are criticizing what government is doing. And this group felt this keenly about, you know, we really did have a real important mission and obligation to give better transparency to the American public and to decision makers.
GovX Executive Director Amy Holmes also moderated the final panel of the day, Realizing the Potential, Applying AI to Open Data in Federal and Local Governments. The panelists included Oliver Wise, Acting Undersecretary for Economic Affairs and Chief Data Officer for the U.S. Department of Commerce, Renata Miskell, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Accounting Policy and Financial Transparency at the U.S. Department of Treasury, Shireen Floyd, Chief Data Officer for the City of Miami, and Matt Sokol, the Chief Data Officer for the Government of the District of Columbia. We'll hear comments from Oliver Wise, Shireen Floyd, and Amy Holmes.
And I think with AI, public expectations are going to change, and I'm hopeful that government will rise to the occasion to do what it needs to do to improve the user experience.
And I said, well, you know, that's I love the mindset, like, you know, identifying the problem, but we need to break that. We need to be more specific when it comes to AI use. So, like, three things off the cuff. I was like, so let's talk about the type of work that's appropriate. So, like, ask them, where are there repetitive tasks? Where can we help productivity? Where is their customers facing need for information? And, like, ask them, like, where you are confident about the quality of the data, and where are your risk levels? Like, you know, should it be issuing a permit out the gate, or should we talk about how to free up the permit or the plan reviewer from this administrative thing they do over and over again? Folks get overwhelmed, and you know, and what I also realize is AI is not something for technologists to face. Like, this has got to be for cross-functional. And so what does that mean? We got to get our workforce more data literate. So if we're not yet doing descriptive analytics, let's not jump to predictive, like with your technology. Let's get everyone understanding their descriptive analytics in their process before we start jumping to, you know, predicting.
If we can better predict the needs of our community and position the government to be ready for those, to be in a time of crisis, we know how to act and respond in a way that is data-driven, precise, and gets people the help they need when they need it. And having the data behind it to do that. If we can look to the critical services that we're providing and combine data sets from not only the federal, state, and local, but community level data and their private sector data, if you combine all of the information about a local community, you can solve problems in bigger ways.
Thanks for listening to our episode on the 10th anniversary of the Data Act. If you'd like to learn more or see the full recording of the Data Act event, go to govx.jhu.edu. And if you'd like to fill out our listener survey, visit our podcast page at govx.jhu.edu/data-points. Please make sure you're subscribed on your podcasting app of choice. And thanks for listening.